Welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. This is James Kamara-Sami coming to you live from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And it was when the result was called in this Midwestern state just over 3.5 hours ago that Donald Trump knew for certain he had won the US presidential election and would be returning to the White House. The 45th president of the United States will now also be the 47th. It's the first time anyone has won non-consecutive U.S. elections since Grover Cleveland in 1892. At the age of 78, he also becomes the oldest person elected to the highest office in this country. Perhaps too old to be called a comeback kid, but a comeback of historic proportions this certainly is. After a campaign which saw Donald Trump injured by an assassin's bullet, a new Democratic opponent, Vice President Kamala Harris, swapped in at a late stage, and which Mr. Trump's opponents have framed as a moment when democracy itself was on the line. In this edition of NewsHour, coming live from Solly's Grill, a diner in northern Milwaukee, we'll be looking at why Donald Trump won the election. We'll get reaction to the result from the United States and from across the world. And we'll ask what the return of a leader whose stock in trade is unpredictability and norm-breaking might mean, not just for Americans, but for the billions across the globe affected by decisions taken in the Oval Office. Well, this is what Donald Trump said when he acknowledged his victory at his headquarters in Palm Beach, Florida.
This will truly be the golden age of America. That's what we have to have. Together we can truly make America great again for all Americans. So I want to just tell you what a great honor this is. I want to thank you. I will not let you down. America's future will be bigger, better, bolder, richer, safer, and stronger than it has ever been before. God bless you and God bless America. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And he went on to reflect on the breadth of his winning coalition.
This campaign has been so historic in so many ways. We've built the biggest, the broadest, the most unified coalition. They've never seen anything like it in all of American history. They've never seen any young and old, men and women, rural and urban. And we had them all helping us tonight, when you think. I mean, I was looking at it. I was watching it. They had some great analysis of the people that voted for us. Nobody's ever seen anything like that. They came from all corners, union, non-union, African-American, Hispanic-American, Asian-American, Arab-American, Muslim-American. We had everybody, and it was beautiful. It was a historic realignment, uniting citizens of all backgrounds around a common core of common sense.
Well, here with me in Solly's Grill for the whole of this program, just on the other side of my huge mug of Solly's coffee brew with its signature butter burger very firmly in the middle of it, is Dr. Lily Gorin, who's a political scientist at Carroll University here in the suburbs of Milwaukee. Welcome to NewsHour, Lily.
Thanks for having me on.
What happened? What do you think has happened here in America?
Well, I think that you saw a tough race that all the polls suggested was going to be incredibly close and turned out to be very close, although the Electoral College numbers will obviously be in Trump's favor, and also Trump winning the popular vote, which he did not do in 8 years ago, indicates that he put together, as he said, a coalition that supported him, and the Harris campaign did not turn out the numbers that they needed to turn out to challenge that.
What does this coalition look like then? I mean, he has framed it as a coalition of all Americans. Is that what it is?
I think that there was definitely a large contingent of Hispanic Americans in a variety of states who moved towards Trump and towards Republicans in general, who were very supportive. And I think that was part of what happened on election night that we saw.
So what was it? What cut through in his message, do you think?
I think that there was an attraction to, while Trump can be a sort of chaotic campaigner and president, that there was also this discussion of kind of the strongman And I think that there's a desire for some sort of stability that he was presenting. I also think, as many commentators have said, that there's an anti-incumbency mood. And that the Biden administration is the incumbent administration, and Trump was able to run against that administration.
What about Kamala Harris and the campaign she ran? Were there missteps? Were there things that she, on reflection, will say, I got wrong?
I think that it's a tough campaign to come into 100 days before the general election in the United States. And I do think that she was part of the incumbent administration, and I think that was part of it. And so I think that there probably are going to be assessments of the campaign. But from a lot of those who have worked on campaigns, many people thought that she did a really good job during the course of the abbreviated campaign that she ran.
But the headwinds were just against her, economic as well as everything else.
Economic, in terms of immigration policy, and so on.
Yeah, we are here in Wisconsin, and once again, it is a bellwether for the country, isn't it? It went 0.7% to the winners of the last two elections. I think slightly more for Donald Trump this time, but it's narrowly gone to the Republicans. What do you think happened here in Wisconsin?
Well, I do think that there was, you know, there was a lot of effort and a lot of attention paid to Wisconsin by both campaigns. And I think that what sort of happened in a lot of places was that the Trump campaign really did push on turning out their voters, if they were regular voters or, as you know, was part of the campaign approach, irregular voters, ones that didn't regularly vote. But I also think that the Harris campaign was not able to run up its numbers as high as they needed to in the Democratic strongholds.
Well, look, there's a lot of sizzling sounds in the background. You can probably hear, and there's some French toast over there waiting for us, I think, but a while to wait, I think. I don't know, Lily, we'll talk about food and drink a bit later on, but I think we want to turn to the meat, the substance of this election, because we're joined now on the line by Stephen Moore, who was an economic advisor to Donald Trump. He's a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank based in Washington, D.C. Welcome to NewsHour.
Thanks so much for having me.
Was it then the economy that won it for Donald Trump, or was it more complex than that?
Well, a couple of observations. One is that, you know, America is a 50-50 country right now. I mean, we're pretty much ideologically split right down the middle. And as you guys were just talking about, you know, this was a very close election in terms of, you know, 51-49, basically. And this has been the case now for the last 10 to 15 years. Trump was able to capitalize on what I call the three I issues. One was obviously illegal immigration, and Joe Biden and Kamala Harris just never fixed the problem. And Americans were incredibly indignant and angry about that. And by the way, I'm very pro-immigration, but they have to come in legally, not, you know, through the illegal channels. Second of all was obviously inflation. And even though inflation had come down a lot since 2022, people still felt the financial stress that was imposed upon them by runaway government spending that unleashed this inflation. And then finally was incomes. The average American family was poorer today than they were 3.5 or 4 years ago. So I think this theme that Trump had of, you know, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And by the way, if that sounds familiar, it's what Ronald Reagan said to the American people when he debated Jimmy Carter 40-some years ago. So I think it was those factors. Kamala Harris, I thought she actually ran a pretty good campaign. You know, as you were just saying, she was kind of thrown into this with 100 days to go. But Trump has really caused a political realignment in America.
Interesting. Well, look, he's set out what he wants to do to fix the economy. He's talked about cutting taxes or imposing tariffs. I mean, tariffs, that could lead to prices being high again or rising for Americans. Do you think the American public would accept that?
You know, I'm not a big fan of tariffs, and I'm an advisor to Trump on the economy, and he and I have disagreed on this, but, you know, he usually...
Really? I mean, that's his number one thing that he talks about again and again, how much he loves tariffs.
That's true. But, you know, with Trump, because this is an audience that isn't in America. But the fact is that Trump actually does use tariffs as a negotiating tactic. I saw him do that in the first term pretty effectively. So sometimes his bark is worse than his bite. But I have to say that even though I'm not, you know, a big fan of tariffs, Americans were really taken to this message that we're going to save American jobs, that we're going to put American workers first, that we're going to, his theme at the end was, look, we're going to lower taxes on things that are produced in America, and we're going to raise taxes on things that are coming in from countries like China. And, for better or worse, Americans the polls show that Americans supported that policy.
And you've focused on that very, I suppose, standard phrase that he used on the campaign trail, that are you better off 4 years mm-hmm. ago than you were now, the Reagan phrase, as you pointed out. But of course, there was a lot of other messaging on that campaign trail. He talked about retribution, revenge, an enemies list. What are we going to see, do you think, at the start of this second term?
I don't think we're going to see that. I really don't. I mean, I think that what, and I hope we don't, because I think Trump needs to
just rhetoric then.
Well, hopefully. I mean, American people don't want that. We don't want to be vengeful, but we want to turn the country around. And there, you know, here's the thing.
But what does Donald Trump want, I suppose, is a question.
Sorry?
But what does Donald Trump want? American people might not want that, but does he want that?
I don't think so. I think that Trump wants to be a successful second-term president. Remember, he's a lame duck, you know, because he only has one term left. He cannot serve another term. So he's got to race out of the gate, do as much, you know, in terms of policy. For example, we will produce more American energy. We will produce our oil, our gas, our coal, our nuclear power. We will be energy independent again. We will get control of the border. I guarantee you that. We will be trying to get some of the, you know, unruly regulations off the back of our businesses. And that was a message that really appealed to workers. Incidentally, I just have to tell you, because I think it's an amazing data point, that Trump won, we don't know the exact number, but he won almost half of the Hispanic vote, which is a huge, huge change. I mean, it used to be Republicans won 25%.
So we don't have too much time, Steve. I just want to ask you, will this second term be different, though? Will he have people around him who are more closely aligned to his worldview, and will that be different?
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, the people who are going to serve for him are going to believe in this kind of Make America Great Again agenda. And I don't think people around the world, I mean, I know a lot of, foreigners are worried about this, but I think he could, if he can bring prosperity to America, you can spread that around the world, and we will see. But that does require more free trade and better and lower taxes and less onerous government, and that's what Trump stands for.
Stephen Moore, economic advisor to Donald Trump, visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Thanks very much. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. And our main headline today, Donald Trump will be back in the White House next year with an America First agenda that he says will herald a new golden age for the United States. The Democratic Party candidate in this presidential election, Kamala Harris, has yet to concede, but Democrats are already trying to figure out what went wrong. Later on NewsHour, we'll be hearing from one of them.
For a while, it seemed like she was on top of the world. This is just a very difficult moment for our party because we didn't have a primary. We didn't have a rigorous primary to see which candidate would have been most formidable against Trump. And if he truly is an existential threat to the Republic, as many of us believe that he is, then we probably should have had that process.
One other headline at this hour, Interpol has announced its biggest ever operation against people traffickers, freeing 3,000 people from an uncertain future. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service with me, James Kamarasamy. We are coming live from Milwaukee in Wisconsin, a state in the Midwest that flipped for Donald Trump and delivered him another 4 years in the White House. Well, as Americans are digesting this historic comeback, so too is the rest of the world. This is what the president-elect had to say about his foreign policy at his headquarters in Palm Beach in the last few hours.
Things be good, safe. We want great education. We want a strong and powerful military, and ideally we don't have to use it. You know, we had no wars. 4 years, we had no wars, except we defeated ISIS. We defeated ISIS in record time, but we had no wars. They said, he will start a war. I'm not going to start a war. I'm going to stop wars.
Well, joining us now is our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, who's in Jerusalem. We're also joined by our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, who's in the Black Sea resort of Sochi, where President Putin is today. Lise, first of all, just remind us, how does Donald Trump see America's place in the world?
His mantra is Americanism, not globalism. America first. And in his first term, I saw him at NATO summits scolding the U.S.'s long-standing European allies, criticizing them for, as he saw it, freeloading off the U.S.'s vast military spending. And both Steve and I saw him at the Helsinki summit with Vladimir Putin when he was asked whether he agreed with his intelligence agencies or with Vladimir Putin about meddling in the U.S. And there was an audible gasp among the journalists when he looked at President Putin and said, well, I agree with him. He's a disruptor in every way, at least he was in the first term. He pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement, the Iran nuclear deal, the World Health Organization. He slashed funding for several UN agencies. And there's a warning now, a real fear, it could be even worse this time.
Lise, you're in Jerusalem at a time of great turmoil in the Middle East. There's been a lot of domestic turmoil in Israel itself over the last 24, 48 hours as well. How is this news being received there?
This is the result of the U.S. elections that the vast majority of Israelis wanted, including the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who not surprisingly was one of the first world leaders to congratulate Donald Trump, and not just with the kind of political messages you saw from other leaders. His was warm, personal. It was sent to Donald and Melania Trump, sent in true friendship from Benjamin and his wife, Sarah Netanyahu. All Israeli leaders right across the political spectrum hailed this strategic relationship and spoke of this long and strong partnership. When it comes to Arab leaders, though, it was interesting. They also talked to a person, whether it was the King of Jordan, President Sisi, the leader, the Emir of Qatar. They also talked about years of working with Donald Trump and with the U.S., but all of them to a leader focused on working with him to bring peace in the region. And this, Jamie, is the big question now. Is it, as we heard in that clip of Donald Trump, is he going to be the peacemaker and stop the wars, as he hinted in the election campaign, including the war in Gaza and in Lebanon? Or will he be the leader who will give an even freer hand to Israel? Because we also heard that in the election campaign, where he's said to have told Prime Minister Netanyahu, do what you have to do. And it's widely expected that that will include hitting Iran even harder.
And briefly, Lise, of course, in his first term, we saw this rapprochement, didn't we? A regional rapprochement that he helped to oversee, the Abraham Accords.
Yes, we did. I was at the first summit he went to in Saudi Arabia, this beginning of a very strong relationship. It ended up being the so-called Abraham Accords, the deals signed with the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Morocco. He has spoken in the campaign of expanding that. He wants Saudi Arabia. But since then, since his first term, Saudi Arabia has now had a rapprochement with Iran and has made it absolutely clear no normalization of relations unless there is a Palestinian state. Big, big question,
Lise,
for Donald Trump.
Indeed, indeed. Lise Doucette, thanks very much. Well, let's turn to Ukraine and Russia, because that, of course, is where another war is taking place. Let's have a listen to how the news of Donald Trump's election has been received by one man who was speaking to the BBC in Ukraine, 41-year-old Alexei Yarocha in the capital, Kyiv.
I guess we are all waiting for just the only thing, just to stop the war. And this Trump promised to stop the war in just one day. We are all waiting for it. So now he is 47th president of the U.S., of the biggest and greatest country in the world. We are waiting for this straight move, stop the war in just one day. It could be today, tomorrow. We can wait till Friday. You're the president. Please do it, Mr. Trump.
Please do it, Mr. Trump, a citizen of Kyiv, saying please stop the war. Steve Rosenberg is with us. Steve, in Sochi. What, first of all, has been the Russian reaction to Donald Trump becoming the president again?
It's been really, really interesting, Jamie, because it's almost as if the Russians have been bending over backwards to
make us believe that they are not excited by Donald Trump's victory, which is kind of strange, really, when you consider that during the election campaign, you know, Donald Trump barely criticised, or perhaps never criticised, Vladimir Putin. He seemed to blame Joe Biden for Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine and not Vladimir Putin. And he questioned the scale of US military assistance for Kyiv. And yet, we heard today a Kremlin spokesman say, well, there are no plans for President Putin to congratulate Donald Trump, and reminding us that, as far as Russia is concerned, America is an unfriendly country involved in a war against America. I think part of the reason for this kind of downbeat reaction is what happened last time Donald Trump was in power, because the Russians had such high hopes for a President Trump to sort of reinvigorate US-Russian relations, and it didn't happen. So they're being a little bit cautious this time.
Yeah. Yes, I remember I was actually in Russia during the inauguration back in 2017 to get a flavour of that excitement that this would be a reset, that this would be the moment when relations changed. And it was interesting, wasn't it? Because the Americans, who were always saying, look, you know, Donald Trump has actually been tougher on Russia than some other presidents in the past.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I remember when Donald Trump won in 2016 and they were opening champagne bottles in the Russian parliament, and Donald Trump was made an honorary Russian Cossack by a Cossack group. And yet,
a Trump burger somewhere, I think you ate, didn't you?
I did. I can't say it was the tastiest thing I've ever eaten, but yes, there was Trump mania across Russia. But that turned to disillusionment as the realization came that actually relations were getting worse and not better.
What about Ukraine? How do you think President Zelensky is going to be viewing this? He has an interesting relationship, to put it mildly, with Donald Trump, doesn't he?
Well, this is the big question. Yes, Trump says he will end the war in a day. How is he going to do that? Will he try and do that by putting pressure on Ukraine to come to the negotiating table, by reducing or stopping US military assistance to Kyiv and forcing Kyiv to capitulate? That's the big question, the big worry, I think, for Ukraine. But it's not clear. I think the Russians, although they appreciate the fact that Donald Trump hasn't said bad things about Vladimir Putin and praises Vladimir Putin from time to time, I think they are a little bit wary. They don't quite know what's in Donald Trump's mind. They understand he's a bit unpredictable. So we'll have to see how this pans out over the next few weeks and months.
Yes, that's right. We know what Donald Trump says. We don't know always whether that reflects what he does in practice. Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor there, joining us from Sochi. And earlier we heard from our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, in Jerusalem. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour. We're coming to you live from Milwaukee in Wisconsin with me, James Kamarasamy. Welcome back to NewsHour. Welcome back to Solly's Grill in northern Milwaukee in Wisconsin. And we're going to reflect now on the fact that the presidential election was not the only election happening in America yesterday. There were races, of course, for the U.S. House of Representatives. Every single seat of the 435 up for grabs. The Senate, there were a third of the Senate races up as well. We have with us Dr. Lily Gorin, political scientist from Carroll University, to help us guide through what's happened, what we know so far. Lily, let's begin with the Senate. It has gone back to the Republicans, hasn't it? Just tell us what happened there.
Yeah, the Republicans early in the evening picked up the seat in West Virginia that was held by Democrat Joe Manchin, who retired.
No surprise there. Joe Manchin actually became an independent, didn't he? And he was very much on the right side of the party.
Yeah, and again, West Virginia is a fairly predictably Republican state at this point as well. And so what you saw there, and then you had a couple of other Senate races, like the one in Nebraska, that was maybe a little bit on the edge. And you had
an independent there challenging the Republican incumbent, was favored to possibly win. That didn't happen, though.
Yes. And again, you know, Ted Cruz won his seat in Texas, where there seemed to be maybe a little bit more of a challenge. Tester in Montana lost his seat.
The Democrat, yeah, in a very red
Republican state.
Very red Republican state. And again, he, you know, he cut a little bit against the grain as well in terms of where he is. Sherrod Brown lost his seat in Ohio. And that was one of the ones where the Democrats were sort of pinning hopes on carrying that seat and therefore being able to maintain at least an evenly divided Senate.
Yeah, it showed, again, Ohio, a state that used to be a swing state, now firmly Republican, and people perhaps switch between parties for different elections less than they do in the past? Is that what we're seeing?
It seems that way, although I'm still waiting to hear the final results in our Wisconsin race.
Ah, yes, it's too close to call still, isn't it? Tammy Baldwin trying to hang on, the Democrat. Well, what about in the House? We don't know yet because it takes a long time. It's been very close. I mean, the Republicans have had a very small majority. The Democrats hopeful that they could at least have that share of power by winning the House of Representatives.
It's very close, and I was just looking up the numbers. At this point, the consensus seems to be the Democrats have about 210 seats and the Republicans have about 207 seats, but it's not, we're not done, and California takes a really long time to count their votes.
Right. Well,
and a number of those seats are in California.
So as things stand, what can we say about this sort of amount of power Donald Trump will have with the Senate on his side?
Well, again, this helps him in terms of judicial appointments to not just Supreme Court seats, but also the entire federal bench. It's the same thing with regard to cabinet appointments. His appointment should probably sail through the Senate in that regard. And it's more than one or two votes, they're probably going to have a comfortable enough majority.
Lily, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Lily Gorin, a political scientist at Carroll University. They're talking us through the congressional races here. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, and we're coming to you live from the legendary diner that is Solly's Grill in northern Milwaukee in the state of Wisconsin, one of the states that went from Democrats to Republicans in the presidential election and delivered a victory to Donald Trump. We are reflecting on the results of this historic vote, and it has been quite a sweep for the party that Donald Trump heads, the grand old party as it's known. Not only did Mr. Trump become the first Republican to win the popular vote in two decades, but as we've been hearing, the Republicans have regained control of the U.S. Senate. The House of Representatives, as we've also been hearing, is still in the air. We don't know how that's going to fall. With me, I'm very pleased to say, is a man who's given us a very huge and very warm Wisconsin welcome here at Solly's Grill, the owner of this diner, Glenn Fieber. Glenn, well, thank you, first of all, for the warm reception. And I think this is a happy day for you, is it not? Because you are a Donald Trump supporter.
Yes, this was a happy day. We didn't know which way this was going. And first of all, I'd like to say thank you to the BBC for choosing Solly's Grill to be here. And we're very proud and honored that you're here. I stayed up for quite a while last night, maybe till midnight. Then I had to get to sleep because I knew I had to come in to see you guys this morning. I did wake up.
We've rather taken you over.
I went to a watch party at a local bar, and it was a great time. And when I left, I think some of the people that were running Hovde and Baldwin, we didn't know which way they were going.
And that's a Senate race. Eric Hovde, the Republican, is still right. Still not sure who's won that one.
Right, yeah. It's very close. And so I didn't know actually what happened until I woke up this morning that we had a new president. I'm hoping that everything goes well. I'm hoping that the Americans weave together again and become one and work together again on this.
So for you, what was the reason? What were the main reasons why you voted for Donald Trump?
Immigration problems that we've had for the last 4 years, and the economy has just stopped everybody from spending. It's hard to run an auto shop here. It's hard to run a restaurant like I do here because people just can't afford anything.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, I mean, personally, how have you felt that?
Yeah, we've felt a diminishing in people coming in, and we have to have people coming in order to stay here. So hopefully that Mr. Trump can bring this back to a good time economically.
Yeah, and well, what about
for the country, though? You put your hands together, you put your fingers together, hoping that Americans can come together after this election. But Donald Trump is, whatever else you want to say about it, he has been a pretty divisive figure, hasn't he?
Yes.
Can he really bring the country together under his leadership?
Well, it's going to rely on many things. The free press, the school systems, are they going to be repaired? Is patriotism going to come back in good force with Donald Trump? We need to have more patriotism and the love of country. And we hope that he does bring this back. The economy, the immigration, Donald Trump is going to be sitting in an office that's full of war right now. Thank God Americans not involved in it that much. But he's got a lot of work to do to try and simmer things down overseas also.
What about simmer things down at home in this diner? Is there much political chat? We spoke to a couple of people the other day. We spoke to one couple who'd popped in. One was a Democrat, one was a Republican. They were kind of pretty open about it. But do people talk about politics? What's the mood like here?
People talk about politics all the time here at the counter. And I do my best to stay out of it and try and be a little neutral. But yes, the politics is discussed here. Business is discussed. The economy is discussed.
And it's done calmly, is it? Because, I mean, that was one of the themes of this election, that this was a moment when, the country, the democracy of America was somehow on the line. And a lot of people were anxious talking to us in the days leading up to this election. Do you think that anxiety is going to dissipate now?
I'm hoping it does. We didn't hear about anything on the radio today that, there was any problems in America after this. They found out that we had a new president, and I was very thankful for that. Maybe it's going to be a little calmer than we thought, and let's hope it is. And let's hope that Donald Trump, and he's a very intelligent man, he can simmer some of this down and hopefully bring America together.
Well, look, Glenn, once again, many thanks for hosting us here. Glenn Fieber, owner of Solly's Grill, with its wonderful oozing butter burgers at the center of the menu, but plenty of other good things.
Thank you very much.
Well, look, thanks again to you, Glenn. We are yet, though, to hear from the defeated Democratic candidate, Kamala Harris. The vice president was, of course, hoping to break that ultimate glass ceiling, but she fell short, just as Hillary Clinton had done 8 years ago. Lindy Lee is a political strategist, and she's been on Kamala Harris's National Finance Committee. She's also women's co-chair at the Democratic National Committee. And earlier on, from Philadelphia, she gave me her reaction to her party's defeat.
Well, I'm at a loss for words. I'm still processing everything, but I'm already doing a bit of a postmortem, and I've kind of reduced our loss to four primary reasons, the first one being immigration. Biden's executive order should have come 3 years ago, not in 2024. And we were just unwilling to admit that things went wrong. I think a little bit of humility in that regard would have been helpful to the American people to acknowledge that, yes, our border could have been more secure. Having said that, I do want to point out to our listeners that Trump was the one who destroyed the bipartisan border deal. He wanted migrants as a campaign issue, which he got. Number two is inflation and the economy. Inflation has come down to 2.1%, but cumulative price hikes are still very much an issue. And number three would be Tim Walz, the choice of him as VP versus somebody like Governor Josh Shapiro, who may have been able to help to deliver the critical battleground state of Pennsylvania.
Fourth reason.
I have one final reason. I don't think President Biden should have run for re-election. And the fact that he stayed in the race for as long as he did really hurt us.
Before Kamala Harris herself speaks, what about her? What about her campaign?
I think one thing she might have done differently is expanding the daylight between her and President Biden. This is a very anti-incumbent mood environment that we're in, and it's not just a uniquely American issue. This is the case around the world in countries like Japan, Canada, and also across Europe. You see it a lot of people are just generally disgruntled about their leaders and they want to throw them out. And inflation is a big reason why.
Let's have a look at what else happened. You lost a popular vote. You have lost support amongst traditionally strong base for you, like the Latinos. Women didn't come out in the numbers that it had been expected, young voters as well. How would you describe what has happened, and how do you come back from this?
We have to acknowledge that America has taken a rightward shift. That is just empirical data that we need to contend with. We cannot be living in our bubble. We need to understand, for example, I'm a naturalized citizen, by the way. I'm a naturalized American. I came here the right way. My family waited in line, you know, in order to come to this country. And we follow the rules. We didn't jump the line. We didn't ask for any favors. And so I think Democrats are maybe incorrect to assume that Latino Americans were all willing to jump on board simply because Democrats were lax on immigration. That's simply not the case, because a lot of these Latino Americans, they've been here for generations already. And their views on immigration reflect largely are the same as Americans in general. And that's
yeah,
how
I mean, I was actually out in a place called Whitewater, not far from here, which has had a focus of the Trump campaign, where they've had a lot of new undocumented migrants. We spoke to exactly that, a Latino, a Mexican-American who'd been here for decades, who said it's not fair that
it's
people come here
fair.
Illegally. And that he
I've
said he was gonna, probably going to vote for
years.
Donald Trump.
I came here as a baby, basically. I came here, I've been here for 30 years. This is basically the span of my lifetime. I don't think it's fair for people to jump the line. My family worked so hard. We came here with $200. We escaped communist China. And so for me, I don't think it's fair that people can just waltz in across our southern border. So I think that's something that Democrats really need to think carefully about. That having strong borders doesn't mean that we're bigots. I think these are we can hold two truths at the same time, that we are kind-hearted, free people, but we also want a legalized and organized manner of immigration. I don't think that's asking too much.
Can I just end with a question, because you are the women's co-chair at the Democratic National Committee.
Oh, this geez, is the I second, know what's coming.
It's the second time the Democrats have nominated a woman for the presidential candidate, and the second time one has lost. Is America just simply not ready for a woman as president?
Given the results of last night, clearly we're not. I'm just looking at the empirical data, and the data says we're not. It's unfortunate.
Lindy Lee there, political strategist, Democratic National Committee Women's Co-Chair. Well, still with me, Lily Gorin, political science at Carroll University, political scientist. Lily, listening to that, it was interesting to hear a Democrat saying America's moved rightwards. And we actually heard earlier from a Republican, a former Trump advisor, saying America's 50-50. How do you see it?
I do think that the United States is fairly evenly divided in terms of political disposition and party affiliation. But I think the election indicates that by the sort of closeness of so many of these races. But I do think that there is this polarization. There's also the identity that people now associate with their political party or their political party is part of their identity in ways that it hadn't been in the past. And so I'm not necessarily sure that the country has moved rightward.
What about what Glenn was saying earlier on, this hope that after this election and a clear victory for Donald Trump, even if it was narrow in individual states, that the country can come together, there can be some kind of national unity? What do you think?
Well, the president as in the office was designed to be a national representative. And that has often been the hope with regard to whomever is elected, be it Donald Trump or Barack Obama or George W. Bush, and we can continue to go back. But that the individual and the campaign themselves didn't necessarily put forward a perspective that was of weaving together, as the owner said. At the same time, that is one of the jobs that the presidents are often tasked with, is trying to represent the entire country.
American democracy, robust as ever?
There were a lot of people who voted. And so we do have sort of the hallmarks of democracy in that regard. And there was a lively campaign. But there is some concern with regard to Democratic slippage.
Lily, thank you very much. We'll be hearing more from you before the end of the program. Lily Gorin there, political scientist at Carroll University here in Wisconsin, with her thoughts on this presidential election, which has delivered a victory for Donald Trump, a historic victory. He becomes the 47th president of the United States, as we've been hearing, and also a big victory for his party, not just in the Senate, but also in the popular vote as well. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from Wisconsin with James Kumarasamy. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour with me, James Kumarasamy, in Wisconsin. And that is the sound of some jubilant Trump supporters celebrating by a highway in Miramar in Florida once it became clear that their candidate would win the presidential election. It became clear, of course, once it was known that he had won this state of Wisconsin. Well, one of the key demographics that the Trump campaign courted was the young male vote, the so-called bro vote. There were more than 40 million Gen Z votes up for grabs in this election. One of them is Joe Mitchell, founder of Run Gen Z, an organization for young conservatives, who joins us now from Palm Beach, Florida. Hi, Joe. Well, tell us about your election night.
James, well, it's good to be here. It was a long night, but it was an exciting night. There wasn't a lot of speech, so I apologize if my voice sounds a little cracked, but we had a lot of fun in Palm Beach. It was a historic night that Donald J. Trump won deservingly so and won decisively. You know, this guy won so big, and he's going to have over 320 electoral votes by the time it's over. And that's what we were hoping for, obviously, not only as a party, but as a country. We wanted something that was done so decisively. People made their voice heard. Democracy was heard last night, and he won big. We were very happy about it.
And he won amongst young voters, which have traditionally been a group that the Democrats have hoped would go for them. What happened? Why has Donald Trump appealed to younger voters?
Well, there's several reasons. And, you know, when you look at the polling, we knew this was going to happen. I mean, the polling was, you know, much different than 2020, 2016. You know, he had a 15, 20 point swing in some of these states with young people, particularly with young men. You know, the strategy that he had to go around and do podcasts with the Nelk Boys and with Theo Vaughn, Andrew Schultz, and Bussin' with the Boys and Joe Rogan was a tremendous strategy. And also, I think, you know, the Democrats, they maybe could have combated it, but Kamala was scared to do that. And when you're scared to go to the people and to the media and alternative media sources about your strategy, then it's probably going to fail and people aren't going to like it. And so when Donald Trump went directly to the people with the go ahead, James.
No, I was going to say, is there an alternative world in which Kamala Harris had appeared on the Joe Rogan show and she'd done a lot better?
Well, I mean, Joe Rogan and about 100 other shows, maybe. You know, she didn't do any media appearances, right? She was scared to do media appearances. Tim Walz was, too. I mean, you've seen J.D. Vance and Donald Trump. They would do anything and everything that they asked them to do. J.D. Vance would go into CNN and MSNBC every day if he could to debate Dana Bash and Rachel Maddow. And Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, they would rarely go in Fox News.
Well, you've mentioned J.D. Vance, who, of course, becomes the first millennial to be elected to this high office of vice president. Well, what does that mean to young men in particular, do you think?
I think it shows that Donald Trump wants to diversify the party. And that's what you've seen last night. James, you've seen a realignment. That's what we call it, the realignment. And so you've seen more young black men. You've seen Hispanic people. You've seen young people in general realigned to wanting to vote for Donald Trump. And so it's a lot less of the educated, more wealthy people in suburbs that want to vote for Trump. And it's the working class people of all races and demographics. And that was the beautiful thing that we've seen last night. That's why he won by so big. It was because of the working class vote that he had.
Just a final question, really. I mean, you've said about him going out there, talking to young people, in particular, using the platforms that they are following their news on. Is there something about his message as well? I mean, this is a man, this is the oldest president to take office. He'll be 78. What is it about his message that has cut through?
Well, he may be 78, but he doesn't look or seem 78. That's number one thing. And he comes off to young people as relatable. And he's talking about things that they care about, the economy, they care about housing, they care about credit card debt, they care about student loan debt, they care about being able to pay car payment. These are the things that young people care about. And Kamala Harris, she did not hit the nail on the head like she needed to. She did not talk about the economy at all. And also young people care about the border. They care about national security. So these are all things that the Democrats have failed to talk on and to speak on. And they failed miserably last night, and they've seen it at the voting polls.
Joe, many thanks for joining us. Joe Mitchell, founder of Run Gen Z, an organization for young conservatives. The voice held up from Palm Beach, Florida. Lily Gorin, a political scientist from Carroll University, who's been with us for the program, listening to that. Are you surprised at all that this strategy of targeting young men who traditionally have not always actually voted, it seemed to have worked?
It did seem to have worked. And again, in terms of looking at past election behavior, it tends to be that, first of all, younger demographics don't vote as much. There's always concern with regard to turning out the youth vote, as we call it. And they're the least consistent voters because they haven't voted before. But I think that the, you know, sort of use of alternative media access and you know, sort of doing things not the way that they had been done in the past, which is one of the things that Trump also did in 2016, definitely paid off here.
And the Democrats, were they just flat-footed when it came to that?
I don't know that they were flat-footed, but I definitely don't think that they were sort of targeting in the same way. I think they were definitely sort of campaigning in a more traditional way.
One of the things that's not traditional about Donald Trump is he is a convicted felon, of course. What is going to happen to his legal cases now? Because there are quite a few outstanding ones still.
There are various outstanding legal cases, and the federal ones will probably disappear when he gets into the White House. The ones that are in the states or localities, he has less capacity to control them, and so they may continue.
What do you think the Democrats will be thinking and looking at now?
Well, again, it's like who voted, what did they vote for, and why did they vote, I think is definitely what Democrats and Republicans will be looking at. And I think that that's part of what happens in the autopsy, usually, as it's called, for the losing party.
Yes, there will definitely be an autopsy, but celebration for the winning party. We've heard quite a bit of both of that on this program. Lily Gorin, political scientist at Carroll University here in Wisconsin. Thanks very much for being with us throughout the hour. It's been quite difficult broadcasting with the smell of the breakfast that is wafting through Solly's Grill over the last hour or so. I'm looking at some people ordering what appear to be some very tasty egg-based breakfasts. I think there'll be one for us soon. Kim, the waitress, has just passed us by. She's been filling up our cups throughout the hour. And it has been an hour in which we have reflected on this remarkable election result. Donald Trump, re-elected to the White House. He will become the 47th president of the United States in an election in which he's won the key swing states, including this one of Wisconsin, from where we have been broadcasting. From me, James Kamara-Sami, and the rest of the NewsHour team, thanks very much for listening.